Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I've got with me our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. And this week, we're going to be talking to Liam Neeson. Yes, Liam Neeson, about his new movie, Honest Thief, as well as Ben Wheatley about his film, Rebecca. Plus, we'll be checking out Borat's subsequent movie film. I'm not going to do the full title. Let's just call it that. And also The Secret Garden, Summer of 85, and His House. So that's a lot to get through. There's no time to tarry, lads. Shall we kick off with this?
His real name is Thomas Dolan, former Marine, demolitions expert.
He needs to come clean. I'm not a bank robber anymore. With the murder one charged for killing one of their own, the feds will come after me and keep coming.
If those two crooked cops are willing to kill another agent, what are they capable of doing to you and me?
My girlfriend.
She had nothing to do with this.
Agent Evans, I'm coming for you.
Do what you have to do.
So that's The Honest Thief, which is about a serial bank robber who tries to turn himself into the FBI, but winds up in a cat and mouse game with two corrupt feds. Jordan, you caught up with the star, Liam Neeson, this week. How was it?
It was great, yeah. It was my first time interviewing Big Liam. And as you'll hear, he was really friendly, really surprisingly funny, happily answered all my daft questions about cupcake vans and what sort of kept him interested in action films since Taken reinvented his on-screen image. But I guess we'll dig a little deeper into that in the review straight after.
Well, let's have a listen. And before we do, was it exciting to be on the phone to Liam Neeson and him not to be making threats to you?
I was a little intimidated at first. You don't want to annoy Liam Neeson while you're on the phone with him.
Not with his particular set of skills.
Yeah, lest he come around and beat me up. But no, it all went well, so I was worried for nothing.
Okay, let's take a listen.
We've all had a very strange year, of course. How's your lockdown been, Liam?
My lockdown has been very interesting. Look, I'm one of the luckiest guys alive. There's millions of Americans out of work and don't know where the next paycheck is coming from, let alone the next meal. I have a house upstate. I've paid off the mortgage. I have a few toys, like a swimming pool, a gym, a screening room, and a library of books. I was able to read 30 to 32 books, including Ulysses by James Joyce and Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, which I'm very proud of.
Wow, busy lockdown.
So it was a good lockdown, actually. Yeah,
yeah, it's good to hear. So Tom, your character in Honest Thief, he's a prolific bank robber who decides to come clean and hand himself into the FBI after meeting and falling in love with Annie, played by Kate Walsh. Yeah. It's quite unusual to see a romantic relationship given this much kind of weight and screen time in a full-throttle action film like this. Was that part of the appeal?
It was, and also because it was a love story of two people of a certain age, let's say. We're not 25 years of age, you know. And there's no scenes of ripping off clothes and bouncing off walls, making love to each other. Not that I've done too many of those, but it was just, there's a couple of simple kisses in it. But it's two people who, certainly for my character, I think, is had discovered love for the first time in his life. And he's supposed to be in his mid-50s, and he decides to come clean as regards his bank-robbing life. And he's doing it all for her, and that's the basic story. But mixed within that, there's a few car chases and a couple of fights and a couple of explosions, of course, being an action movie. But it was fun to do. And we shot it up in Worcester actually 2 years ago.
Right.
Worcester's quite close to Boston, and it was kind of like being back home in Northern Ireland, because there was a Presbyterian church almost at every street corner. it really reminded me of being back home.
Awesome. You played an extremely dishonest thief for Steve McQueen in Widows a couple of years back. Is it more fun to play characters with or without a moral compass?
Widows, definitely that guy didn't have a moral compass in any shape or form. I loved working with Steve McQueen, and a beautiful Viola Davis was just sensational, you know. I haven't played too many guys without a moral compass, but it's fun to kind of expand a little bit, you know. And Steve allowed me to do that. It was a very good script, too.
So Tom's bank robbing days are pretty much behind him when we meet him in the film, but we do get a few flashbacks to previous bank robberies. Did you receive a kind of crash course in blowing open safe doors in order to play Tom?
A little bit. We had a kind of technical expert there. Not that he was an ex-bank robber, but we had a guy who kind of knew about how to break into safes, the gelignite to use and stuff like that. So I had a little pep talk from him, you know?
Could be a useful skill one day, you never know.
Of course, I hope not, but yeah, maybe.
Have any of the skills you've sort of picked up in your career playing these very kind of capable individuals, have they proved useful in real life at any point?
Well, strangely enough, I've worked with quite a few ex-SAS guys. When I say ex, they've given up soldiering, but they're still in the field of security, let's put it that way.
Right.
And nearly all of them say the same thing. If you see any sign of trouble, for example, in a bar, he says, just check where the door is and leave. Absolutely leave. He says, you're not being a coward. You leave. You don't know if that guy coming at you or wants to start a fight has a knife, has a gun, is going to break a glass. He says, just leave. Because if you start trying to be a brave man and throw punches and stuff, it could end up disastrously, no matter how fit and well-trained you are, you know. They nearly all say that, which I find interesting.
Yeah, it's good advice.
So that's the skill I've learned, is to look for the door, get the hell out of Dodge.
I like it. I enjoyed one of the film's big kind of set-piece car chases, features your character being pursued by a police car while he's in a delivery van loaded with baked goods. Did you sneak a cupcake between takes?
Yeah, actually, I did. They gave me a couple of Raisin Bran gluten-free muffins, which I love, actually.
The set decorator did a good job then.
Yeah, he did. He did. And we smashed it all to pieces with gunshots and stuff.
So action filmmaking is something you've really leaned into as an actor, especially since Taken and the success of that film. I mean, what makes characters like Tom Nolan from Honest Thief and Brian Mills, what makes them so much fun to play?
Well, it's just the execution of them. You know, I'm like a kid in a toy shop. When we first shot the first Taken movie, which was actually 13 years ago, I was actually in Shanghai at the Shanghai Film Festival with my wife, and I ran into Luc Besson. And I said, look, I've read your script, this Taken. I said, I'm sure I am nowhere near your list, but for what it's worth, I'd love to do it. I said, I used to be a boxer as a kid, and I've done a few sword fights and cowboys in armor, I would call them, films and stuff. But I'd love the chance to do this, and I think I could give it some kind of humanity as well. Anyway, lo and behold, Luke offered me the film, not there and then, but after 2 or 3 weeks, he wanted me to do it, and I felt great. I spent like 3 months in Paris doing this, hanging out with these wonderful stunt guys, and Mark Vanslow, who's my stunt kind of coordinator. We've done 24 films together. We're about to do our 25th down in Australia. I leave in about a week's time. So it was great. You know, we'd train every morning, and we'd choreograph these fights, and it was terrific. I really, really was like a kid in a toy shop. I loved it. And then Fox Studios made a success out of the film, certainly in America. And then, lo and behold, it led to, you know, Taken 2 and then ultimately Taken 3. And I'm still getting offered action scripts. And I'm not 10 a week, far from it. But, you know, every now and again, there's one drops through the letterbox. If it's reasonably good and has a reasonably good storyline, I'll do it. I really do like doing them. And everybody says, oh, you do your own stunts. That's not true. I do not do my own stunts. I do my own fighting, which I love doing. But as regards jumping through windows and stuff like that, I leave that to Mark.
Yeah, leave that to the professionals, definitely.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Incredibly, it's now 21 years since The Phantom Menace, believe it or not. You've voiced Qui-Gon a few times over the years, of course, but have you ever wished that you could throw the robes back on and jump back in front of the camera as Qui-Gon once again?
I'll be honest with you, Jordan, no. Not because I didn't have a good experience. I had a wonderful time working with George Lucas and a young Natalie Portman and Ewan McGregor. the one was enough for me, you know. It was just, right. And those were the early days of CGI and all that stuff, you know. So it was interesting. It was just interesting. There were cameras with tubes coming out of them, wires coming out, linking up to laptop computers and stuff. So it was all a little bit intimidating. The one was enough. I'm very proud to have been in it. I'm glad I wasn't signed up for two or three, you know.
All right, fantastic. I've got to let you go, Liam. Thanks very much for your time. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jordan. Take care.
So that's Liam on his new film, Honest Thief. We got a chance to watch it. Who's in it apart from Liam? Jordan, tell us.
Well, quite a lot of recognisable faces, actually, including Jai Courtney, Anthony Ramos, Jeffrey Donovan.
Kate Walsh,
yeah.
So of Grey's Anatomy fame.
And more recently of The Umbrella Academy, but we'll get to her in a minute. So yeah, Liam Neeson stars as Tom Carter, as previously mentioned. He's a serial bank robber who decides he's going to pack in blowing up safe doors for good when he meets Annie, played by Kate Walsh. Tom sort of knows Annie is the one as soon as he meets her, of course, and he doesn't want any secrets between them. So he decides he's going to confess to the FBI that he is the fabled In-N-Out Bandit, as he's been named by the press.
The In-N-Out Bandit, love it. He's not particularly fond of that name.
He really doesn't like that name, does he? But yeah, things start to go pear-shaped when Jai Courtney and our old podcast pal Anthony Ramos show up at his hotel door, because instead of, you know, taking Tom in after he's confessed, they decide they're just going to steal his money and then frame him for murder. So naturally, Big Liam doesn't take this too well, and Tom goes on the run in order to sort of expose these corrupt agents and clear his own name, even though he's still, you know, a serial bank robber and should be in jail anyway.
This is standard Liam Neeson fare, isn't it? You know, he makes threats down the phone. He's like an ex-Marine and he can blow shit up and, you know, he's good at fighting and he drives a cupcake van extremely well. Is it any good? Jack, did you like it?
I didn't mind it.
glowing praise.
Yeah, put that on the poster. The movie's basically what you imagine it to be from Jordan's description. There's nothing particularly surprising about it. There's nothing particularly like inventive about it. It's like pretty bog standard action with dialogue you expect and a romance that feels like a Hallmark movie or something. It was completely fine. I mean, I was a bit disappointed by the action, to be honest. You know, with these kind of films, you put up with some of the more clunky dialogue and pacing because you expect like really good fight scenes and stuff. But I found them not particularly well cut. It wasn't as engaging as some of Liam's other action movies. But I could be in the minority. What did you guys think?
Well, I think the thing with the action is he's not like Brian Mills in Taken, right? He's not this professional killer. He's just a sort of scrappy bank robber who's had this military training, but he's not out there doing kung fu or whatever and shooting people willy-nilly. I thought the action in it was a bit more enjoyable when it had a bit of fun with it. The aforementioned cupcake van, which is involved in a sort of chase sequence in the middle of the film, I thought was quite enjoyable just because it's quite funny watching Liam Neeson trying to stay incognito in this like garish pastel blue van. But the actual fights are a little bit so-so.
It's very much an OAP one, isn't it? It feels creaky in every respect. And as you say, he's not Brian Mills, but I don't get it at all. There's some weird sort of moral murkiness going on here. This entire idea that this guy who has robbed 9 banks, I think it's 9, over 9 years, he's got $9 million of other people's money. And throughout, we're asked to sort of choose him as the good guy, and that these two corrupt FBI agents are bad guys because they've taken his money, but he's taken other people's money. Hello.
He's honest, Jane. That's all that matters.
He's honest after 9 years of incredible dishonesty. I've been robbed. I've been mugged. I don't feel like, oh, you're a nice guy because you're in love with your girlfriend. That's okay. And this whole idea that he's going to turn himself into the FBI, he makes this deal with them, or tries to make this deal. He's like, I'm going to give you back all the money, but what I want is a reduced sentence. I want to be imprisoned in Boston and I want daily visitation from my girlfriend. And they're like, well, this guy seems, you know, quite a decent guy. What? When has giving the money back ever given you the free ride? So that, the very premise of it is ridiculous. But then you add into that this girlfriend, Kate Walsh, God love her. She's trying her best with this role, but this woman who's a psychiatry student and during her affair with Tom has never noticed anything amiss. Also, he's got $9 million that he hasn't spent a penny of. How is he earning his money? How has he been taking her out on dates? No explanation. And then he suddenly tells her while she's being shot at, oh, by the way, love, I've been a robber. And she's like, I'm appalled. But within seconds, she's not appalled. And she's actually getting turned on by him blowing people's houses up. Like, he blows up a man's house and she goes, wow, I found it preposterous. Then you throw into the mix the FBI agents. There's Jai Courtney and Anthony Ramos, as you say. Ramos trying to inject a bit of humility in there. Jai Courtney wearing a toddler suit. I don't even understand what his sort of thing was. He's just going for full-on bad guy, but useless and angry. Tries to kill somebody and doesn't even manage that. and they're like, oh, do they have a pulse? I don't think so. Let's leave it. Oh, that's a great idea, FBI agents. You're really good at your job. So it just... everything about it. The man with the dog, you know, that denotes...
dog.
there's an FBI agent with a dog and this denotes a good guy. I mean, all of it was infuriating for me.
I did enjoy that Jeffrey Donovan basically tried to make a mark by just carrying around this little puppy throughout the entire film, because there's really no other facet to his character other than the fact that he has this dog that he's got in the divorce with his ex-wife. Tells you all you need to know about how much sort of characterization went into
there is no characterization and no logic either. And you know, the fact that, you know, this weird sort of morality that it's fine for Tom to blow up a family house in pursuit of his justice, but it's not okay for people to take his money for their families. It's so murky. But if you don't think about it too hard, it's fine. It's chewing gum for the eyes.
I definitely tried not to think about it too much. My main issue is I don't know why he did it in the first place, why he robbed all these banks. If he's so honest, why do you even bother in the first place? Everything from there crumbles for me. And that was when I was like, I'm just going to have to turn off and just enjoy the action. Even that wasn't particularly up to scratch. I know he wasn't his, you know, Taken character, but like, they don't make a film about someone who's an OAP honest thief, you know, do someone who actually is going to go kick ass. You're right, like Kate Walsh, that scene where she's watching the house explode and suddenly she's got the hots for him and you're just like, this makes no sense at all.
No, and just like, I mean, he springs someone out of hospital who has been badly injured and he's like, we've got to get you out of here. And they are, you know, a witness in a crime. No explanation of how he does that. Suddenly she's in a hotel room, absolutely fine. They just gloss over any detail, don't they? You have so many questions.
You do. But to be fair to this film, it's not trying to be, you know, like Heat or something, even though it steals a lot from Heat. You just kind of know what to expect going in, and it doesn't try to be any more than it is. If you go in expecting something a little bit brainless and a little bit fun, then you'll probably enjoy it. But if you're expecting anything more than that, like literally anything more than that, then you're going to be disappointed.
So this is for Liam Neeson fans and people wanting something that doesn't test their brain power, something very easy to watch.
Yeah, exactly. Liam Neeson has carved out a very sort of successful niche as an action star. And if you like what he does in films like Taken, the Taken trilogy and Nonstop and all those films, you'll probably enjoy this as well. But for anyone who hasn't been convinced by those films, there's nothing in there that's going to persuade you.
Okay, so that is The Honest Thief, which hits cinemas this Friday. All right, so on to our second guest now. So last week we reviewed Rebecca as it hit cinemas, and this week it lands on Netflix. It's an adaptation of Daphne du Maurier's celebrated novel, and it tracks a young woman played by Lily James as she marries a wealthy widower, Armie Hammer, and discovers that his dead wife, Rebecca, is hard to compete with. Yesterday, I talked to director Ben Wheatley about taking on a story that Hitchcock so famously took on. So for people who haven't seen the Hitchcock film or read the book, how would you describe Rebecca to somebody who has no idea?
It's a romance film that takes a very awful turn.
Okay.
That's my elevator pitch.
That's your elevator pitch. That's the log line. And so for people who have read the book and have seen the film, is it important that they leave their preconceptions of those two things at the door before watching this?
I guess so. If I think about my own experiences of watching things, it's a difficult one, isn't it? It's kind of, I don't really want to demand anything of anyone particularly, you know. I don't know why you wouldn't leave your preconceptions at the door if you go and watch something that you've consciously know about another version of it.
Some reviewers have seemed to be unable to move past Hitchcock as the sort of the first film that was made of this. Has some of that sort of vitriol that's been sort of seen surprised you? I mean, or is it something that you have to expect when you take on something that's as famous as this?
I think I always knew it would be like that, yeah. But I think it's also part of the reason I did it as well, because like reading the script made me question my own memory of both the film and the book. And when I read the reviews, I feel that the things they're talking about don't seem to match to the actual reality of the film and the book as well. So they kind of seem to be suffering from the same dissonance, I think. But what can you do? You know, I was chatting to Army Hammer about it and then looking through our texts during lockdown and going, oh, all right, here's the one where I said we'd both get a kicking for remaking Rebecca, you know.
What were the sort of things that you wanted to make sure were very Ben Wheatley about this?
I don't think you have any choice when you make stuff to make it like you. Like how directing works, as far as I understand it, is that as a director, you're kind of a conduit for the story. So you're one of the many filters, or the final filter, after the filter of the art department and the costume and the actors and the cinematography. And you're kind of controlling all those things. And then you're in a kind of performance empathy feedback loop with watching it happen and talking to the actors and going back and forwards. And what comes out the other side, for better or for worse, is gone through you. And that's the you-ness of it. To have a conscious idea of what a style is problematic, I think. You know, that if you think, I have to do this to be like myself, then you're kind of screwed. Which is what you would be in your real life. You know, in normal life, you don't kind of consciously go, what's my me-ness that I'm going to project today? What is that thing that makes me me? You know, and I think you would end up chasing your tail and end up in some kind of psychoanalysis quite quickly if you've acted like that. And I think that's the same with directing. Inevitably, you find that you're in the film.
You know, some people say that directors say that films are sort of like a document of a certain period of their life. Do you look at Rebecca as a sort of document of how you were feeling at that time? And do you see that when you watch it now, that it's sort of that summer, you know, last year, and what you were trying to achieve with it?
The films are usually political in some way, that they've kind of reflecting the time. It's a harder one to pick out of the more period ones. When I ended up having to do the press and start talking about Rebecca, it made me think about it a lot more than going back on it. And it's kind of that idea of, there seems to be a lot of the layers of Rebecca, and it's from the De Maurier obviously, but it's like this idea of like, who owns the truth and who's telling the truth, and how do you unpick the truth from all these kind of layers of things? And I think that's the thing that speaks to now, you know, as much as we did the summer that we shot it. You know, that seems to be increasingly the issue of, who do you trust? When I listen to myself doing the interviews, who I come out against the most is De Winter. You know, I can't stand him. And he's like, he's obviously the proper villain of the whole thing. I love that De Maurier did that to
the swoony heartthrob is actually the bad guy.
It's the trope. It's the weird, sexy widower, isn't it? And he's a swine.
So you cast your good friend as a weird, sexy widower. Just tell me a little bit about casting Armie Hammer and Lily James as this couple that's much more attractive and younger than we've seen in sort of TV adapts and things.
The playing of the romance was really important to me, and I wanted you to believe that they were in love, so there'd be much more at stake when it collapsed. And I really wanted you to feel that. I like that idea of the portmanteau-ness of it, or the kind of the segmented thing of like, that section in France was like a free holiday that you take the audience on holiday and get them to taste that romance, and that you can smell the briny, salty air in the, you know, the south of France. And then you wrench them to England and to Cornwall. And each part of it feels like a little specific like areas that you take them to feel that journey.
Tell me about casting Kristen Scott Thomas as Mrs. Danvers, the fierce housekeeper who gaslights the new Mrs. De Winter. When I spoke to Kristen, she told me that she'd really chased you for this role. So what did she do to convince you that she was so right for it?
She didn't have to convince me at all. I mean, you know, I think as soon as her name appeared on the list, that was the end of it. You just go, oh, yeah, of course. What were we thinking? Yeah, of course, that could only be her. And I remember it very differently. I hear this story. I see this bouncing around from Kristen, but I remember like kind of being really worried and really hoping she'd do it. It was more like that. She's just being kind, I think. We were desperate for her to do it.
Yeah. I mean, she is truly monstrous in this and wonderful, but also incredibly vulnerable. And, you know, you've talked about the fact that you find De Winter to be the villain in this, but really you sort of give Mrs. Danvers a lot of heart. Was that something that was important to you at the beginning, that she wasn't just this sort of gaslighting old bag in the attic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was in the Jane Goldman script very much. I like that. And I kind of like the idea of the film within the film, that Danvers could have had her own movie, or she's more like a kind of Agatha Christie character, you know, discovering what's going on. And I believed her when she spoke. I felt like she was speaking to me and to the audience all the time.
You must have had a favourite sort of scene or moment that you thought going into it, I can't wait to get to film this. Was there one in particular that you were just like, this is going to be cracking to get my hands on this?
I really enjoyed the scene with Favell in the library when he kind of does the blackmail note. That was Sam Riley's first day on the shoot as well. So he walked in completely cold and then did that. And everyone was like, oh my God, that's fantastic. And just the feel of it, like the kind of the movement of the camera and the blocking of it, I really enjoyed that. And it felt like it was at his most kind of late 30s, early 40s-ness. And it felt like the centre of the film in that respect of like the kind of the twists and the turns happening in real terms, like the engine room of the movie.
Just before you go, can you tell us anything about this horror film that you've been making in lockdown? You've not been sitting around watching Netflix. You've actually been out making a film. What have you been doing and why?
The first week I had the lockdown, I was like, oh my God, I didn't know what was going on. Like a lot of people, I was just completely freaking out. And then I thought I was going to watch a lot of stuff. This is the perfect excuse. I can't do anything but watch movies. And I didn't want to watch anything. I was miserable. So I thought I'd write something. So I started writing this thing. And then I talked to Andy Stark, producer that I worked with at Rook Films. So he made this film and it was just amazing to get out. But the actual what it is, I'm kind of keeping under wraps because you can only ever say that once. And we're probably better to say that closer to when it comes out. It's a return, it's a down and dirty horror film, basically.
And is it informed by the COVID sort of crisis? Is there an element of that in it?
Well, to a degree. And what it was more was that I felt that COVID itself or the lockdown is such a massive moment. It's a bit like coming back from the other side of the Second World War or something like that, to a degree, you know, that everything changes, social stuff's changed, which is the laugh of making something that maybe the thing we've made won't even make any sense by the time, you know, when we're all riding around on motorbikes with Mohicans fighting over tins of beans in 6 months' time.
It's gone full Mad Max.
Yeah, exactly. So the script itself, it's not about COVID, but it incorporates it. So it doesn't try to duck it. It's not like the way EastEnders works, where they don't all just sell up their houses and become multimillionaires because they all live in gentrified East London, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't forget about what's happened. That's the problem, isn't it? Is the forgetting.
And it's weird to watch anything where people just go about their business and don't social distance or hand sanitize. Yeah. It feels like another world, doesn't it? Oh, another crowd. Lifetime.
And I can't help just tutting. Oh, oh.
That's not 2 meters. Keep away. And just quickly, can you tell us anything about where Tomb Raider 2 is? I mean, is that just completely
in the COVID zone? Yeah, yeah. So I think all big production stuff like that is tricky.
Well, anyway, thank you so much for your time and for doing this. It's really a pleasure to talk to you again. And I look forward to hearing about the next film whenever you're ready to unwrap that. Can't wait.
Cool. Thank you.
So that's Ben Wheatley on Rebecca. If you want to make your own mind up about it, it is on Netflix right now. Okay, so from Thieves and Aristocracy to this chap.
14 years ago, I released a movie film which brought great shame to Kazakhstan. But now I was instructed to return to Yankee Land to carry out secret mission.
I go to America! Borat!
What do you say? No, it's not me.
Okay, so this is Borat's subsequent movie film. Jack, where do we find Borat 14 years after his first film?
Well, we find him being taken the piss out of in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan aren't happy about the first Borat film. Borat made their country a mockery, and so he's been kind of punished throughout the years. But then he's been brought back to the fore because the Kazakhstan officials want him to go on a secret mission to America to make amends with new President Donald Trump. Obviously, they won't be able to reach Donald Trump, so they decide to gift the head of culture in Kazakhstan, who happens to be a monkey called Jimmy, to Vice President Michael Pence, or as he's called in the movie, Michael Penis. And that's kind of the pull of the movie. And then Jimmy, the monkey, gets shipped over, but instead of the monkey, it is Borat's daughter who has eaten the monkey en route. The movie sees Borat making his daughter kind of attractive enough to be a gift to Mike Pence.
Let me stop you there, Jack. Don't say any more because we don't want to give away some of the amazing moments in this film. So let's not do anything spoilerish, but let's talk about this generally. Is this funny? Is this timely? Is this an important film?
It's incredibly timely. It's not a coincidence that it's releasing before the presidential election in 2 weeks, because it's designed as a film, which, you know, to a certain extent, the first one was as well. It's very much sort of holding a mirror up to the hypocrisy and the bigotry in certain subsections of American culture. Borat spends most of his time hanging around conservative America because, you know, as with the first film, most of the sketches in this film involve real people who are unwitting to the fact that they are in a film with a made-up character at this point. And Borat's doing the most outrageous things, which they're happily going along with and humiliating themselves by participating in. Some scenes are absolutely jaw-dropping. Like, you can't believe that people like this even exist. Like, you can't believe that they don't realize that they're being pranked or they're in some kind of joke.
But it's also incredibly horrifying and saddening that they feel okay to be casually racist, to be casually sexist, for their own daughters to say, "Dad, effing gross," at them when they say disgusting things. It's sort of like funny, not funny, isn't it? Because it's so bleak, actually.
Watching every scene, you kind of just go, "Oh God, I can't believe they're about to do this." I mean, compared to the first one, I think the first one was more shocking because I really didn't expect any of that at the time. And this time around, it's still shocking because you can't believe these people exist, but you also can believe they exist more because it feels like we've kind of come to expect that from certain sections of America.
Well, also, like, in the 14 years since the Borat film, we've actually got a Borat as a president of the United States in a sense, haven't we? We're actually seeing a sort of Borat film in the news headlines all the time. So this really goes to work at showing institutional racism, sexism. He goes to a synagogue. That's a moment that's actually beautiful and really quite moving, because there's not only bad people in this film, are there? This really highlights the kindness, understanding, and extreme patience of people as well that are just lovely, as well as the nitwits.
Yeah, that's true. There were a few people where I was like, "Oh, you're actually incredibly sweet for putting up with this actually quite horrible, bigoted man." But for the most part, I was just horrified by some of the people that he came across in this film. There are examples in the trailers, if you've been watching them, like he goes to a woman's health clinic, which is run by this pastor. And he seems to care more about the fact that Borat's daughter wants an abortion, the fact that he is willingly admitting to having impregnated his own daughter, which is just horrifying on many levels. And that just continues throughout the film. But I actually found that scene you're referring to in the synagogue, I actually found that quite upsetting. There is a bit more to that scene.
There's end title card as well, which makes it even more moving.
And there is a sort of respectful element to it as well, because Sacha Baron Cohen actually broke character to reveal what he was doing to that person, because what he's doing is genuinely horrific. So if you're not sort of aware of that context, I think that scene could actually be quite upsetting to watch. But there is a bigger story to that scene.
And also the extra layer that he himself is actually Jewish. So a lot of those sort of exposés of sort of Jewish hatred is incredibly painful to watch.
And only he can really get away with it. There is a point to it all, and I think that's why he can do it. The one sort of slight problem I had with this, a big problem that I had with this, is a problem that the film itself acknowledges, is that Borat himself is simply like too famous and too recognizable now to actually be himself for most of the film. So he actually goes undercover and dresses up in a lot of different costumes and as different characters throughout a lot of the film. So it feels like you're not actually watching a Borat film for a lot of the film. I don't know if you had this experience as well.
It felt a bit like a Jackass film, you know, when Johnny Knoxville dresses as an old man and does horrific things in clinics and things. There was an element of that.
Or if you watched Who Is America, Sacha Baron Cohen's TV show, where he sort of dressed as a series of characters and essentially did the Borat thing in, you know, humiliating, bigoted conservative Americans. It just felt odd for that to be the case in a Borat film, where you just expect to see, you know, wall-to-wall Borat. It was like, oh, I'm just watching Sacha Baron Cohen dressed as a different character for the next 10 minutes, okay? Which I just felt slightly disappointed by after, you know, waiting 14 years for another Borat film.
But then you do get a new character, his daughter, who's played by Jordan.
Maria Bakalova.
Yeah. And she's sort of, for my money, she is the Borat in this. She sort of fulfills that function. And actually, it's really interesting, you know, to get a makeover to become the ultimate ideal image of womanhood and where that takes her. And that takes her to some dark places, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
I think she's the highlight of this film for me. I mean, it did feel like with Sasha, I love Sasha a lot. And I think his performance is really fun. But it did feel like he was going through the motions of these other characters. It kind of all hinged on this. I mean, it ended up being a nice relationship with his daughter. You know, I was slightly disappointed that his manager didn't come back from the first one.
Mm.
They kind of explained that away with a joke. And so she kind of fulfills a different function. I think it really works. It could have just been a bunch of sketches all in a row trying to punk, you know, a few conservatives and stuff. And I think this really adds a through line that I found really fun and funny. And I think she's great. She matches, you know, Sasha, the deadpan delivery in front of, you know, all these people. I mean, you could watch half the movie from like between your hands because it
I
is...
know the balls on these two. I mean, how they dare to do some of the things. We won't say what, but they do meet a couple of incredibly famous people, politicians, and the lengths they go to in those scenes are astonishing and very revealing.
What's also interesting is like you could see that the movie changed quite a lot because of the coronavirus.
Yes.
You know, the big moment in the trailers they've put out is Sasha dressed as Donald Trump running into a Michael Pence rally with his daughter over his shoulder. We've seen that, so we could talk about that. But it goes one step further later on.
Mm.
And it feels like maybe that Michael Pence part was supposed to be the original end of the movie. And then suddenly there was like this whole new thing happened. And it does feel like, you know, there's an extra urgency to the movie now. You know, it's made even more timely by the fact that, you know, we're still in a pandemic and this movie's dealing with the issues we're going through. And I was reading beforehand about Sasha going into this house with some conservatives and spending like 5 days with them, unable to break character the entire time.
Wow.
That was one of the highlights of this movie for me as well. I thought that entire sequence is hilarious.
That sequence is incredible because it just really exposes the totally backwards thinking of certain people in America, because they totally buy into these, you know, conspiracy theories put forward by Trump and numerous Republicans in America. But the second that they're presented with conspiracy theories that Borat believes in, these cultural stories, which are patently ridiculous, they're the first to kind of shoot them down. It's like, can they not see themselves that they are just exactly the same as Borat? They just believe different, obviously completely wrong things. That just kind of blew my mind a little bit. The one thing that has to be said is that obviously humor is completely subjective and everything, but I didn't find this anywhere near as funny as the first Borat, which might be seen as a critical failing, but isn't necessarily, because I don't think this is just trying to be funny. There are a couple of big laughs. There's a surprisingly sweet scene where Borat cuts this guy's hair, which I found like really amusing. It's not like one of the, you know, showstopper sequences or anything, but really tickled me. But for the most part, it just felt like, I don't know, I was kind of smiling or grimacing throughout the film, but I was never sort of, you know, laughing out loud and rolling around in the aisles. It was more like I was tickled, but not laughing out loud. I don't know. What did you guys think? Were you similar or?
Yeah, I mean, because I think because it is so real and so not elevated, not blown out of proportion, it's difficult to laugh at some of the things that he's doing, because this is the reality of not just in the US, you know, in the UK as well. The sort of extreme political leanings of people and the sort of destructive nature of that. I think it all really tied together, though, at the end, the very end of the film, you just get go vote as a sign. This mania that we're watching, this lunacy, can only be changed if we vote. That's the way to get out of this mess. And I thought that really tied up why it didn't feel completely hilariously laughed out loud funny. What did you think, Jack?
I agree. It was more full of gotcha moments. You know, there are still humorous scenes that, you know, there was like a, you know, a dance routine that's particularly funny.
Yes.
You know, there are all these funny bits scattered in, but it felt more urgent in a political way. It's a different beast to the first Borat. I don't know if people who are, you know, just want to see something funny like the first Borat will be slightly disappointed by that. But at the same time, it is quite eye-opening as well.
But also you want to see this film because everybody's going to be talking about that thing that he did with them and when they did that thing and where the faces of those people when they saw him do that thing. You're going to want to have seen this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a real sort of talking point film, I think, when it comes out this Friday.
Okay, so that is Borat, the subsequent movie film, which is out on Amazon Prime this Friday. Get your daughter and watch it if you have one. And if you don't, watch it.
Get your monkey if you don't.
Get your monkey, exactly. Try not to eat your monkey. Okay, shall we move on to something for the family then? It's half term and this is coming out.
Shall I tell you a story? It's the story of an orphan girl. It was sent to live in a mysterious house.
If you cause me trouble, I'll have you sent away in an instant. You understand?
Where she discovered something. Something magical. Something secret.
So this is The Secret Garden. Jordan, how is this different from other Secret Gardens? We've seen quite a few of these now. How is this different?
That's true. Well, there's this thing called CGI now, which makes the garden real pretty. But apart from that, it's pretty much what you might expect from the latest adaptation of, you know, the classic children's novel. So this stars Dixie Eggerichs as Mary, Colin Firth as Archibald, and Julie Walters as Mrs. Medlock, who will all be characters you're familiar with. But if you don't know the story, it opens in India where Mary lives with her parents until they both die during a cholera outbreak. Mary is sent to England to live with her uncle Archibald in Misselthwaite Manor in Yorkshire. Archibald himself has gone through a sort of recent trauma after the death of his wife and is pretty much a recluse in his own home. And he leaves Mary to Mrs. Medlock and their living maid, Martha. Mary's cousin, Colin, he also lives in Misselthwaite Manor, but he never leaves his bedroom as he's unable to walk due to some, you know, mystery ailment and the fear that he will one day develop a hunchback like his father. Colin and Mary, we should say, are basically spoilt brats.
Yeah.
So Colin sort of meets his match in Mary, who sets about exploring the manor's incredible gardens, which Archibald has kept under lock and key ever since the death of his wife. And these gardens are basically dead at the point that Mary comes across them. But the blossoming sort of friendship between Mary and Colin and Martha's 12-year-old brother, Dickon, who sort of roams around the gardens. Not exactly clear doing what. He just seems to run around exploring. That friendship sort of brings this magical garden back to life. And the garden really is the main attraction here. Watching Mary and her friends sort of bound around this, you know, verdant fauna. It is a real joy. There's some really beautiful sort of cinematography and location work here, particularly right now, given that many of us have barely ventured outside our houses for the last 9 months. It's a bit like going on a holiday, like watching this film and watching these kids run around these beautiful gardens.
I mean, it's supposed to be one garden, but it's actually, as with most film magic, it's about 7 different UK famous gardens, including Fountains Abbey and a beautiful one in Cornwall with those luscious plants. And so it's this sort of amazing scape for them to run through, isn't it? And the garden's sort of symbiotic with them. It breathes with them. It changes colour. It's sort of psychedelic, isn't it? I was actually on set of this for the bit when the children actually run through the gates that they've discovered to this garden, through this wall and into this wonderful wonderland. And it was amazing because obviously the greensmen, as they're known on set, had created this gorgeous flowering wall and beautiful mossy bank and all of this stuff. So it's incredible to see. But you're right, the CG does really enhance these amazing real life gardens.
There are some moments where they've clearly used visual effects and you're never in any doubt that this isn't real, but it never felt like too much to me. Like a lot of the work felt quite subtle and quite beautiful. Like there's one moment where Mary's sitting by this little stream and I think it's the butterflies on her dress suddenly start coming to life and flying off. And I thought that was just a really lovely touch and a really kind of creative and artistic use of CGI when you could have gone completely overboard and had, you know, little creatures running around or whatever. I think
there is a CGI robin, isn't there?
Yes.
Tiny CGI robin. That's not jarring. That's fine.
I presume that's because you can't train an actual Robin to do the things it needs to do in the film. Now, for the most part, I thought CGI was actually used incredibly well and did enhance. You know, this garden has to be absolutely mind-blowing for it to deliver on the promise of the story. And I think it's practically impossible to do that without CGI at this point, given what audiences are used to. I didn't mind them using new technology in this film.
Did you like it, Jack?
No.
Oh. here we go. Here comes Scrooge.
I like the garden. That was nice. But I just found the kids unbearable in this. I know they're supposed to be spoiled little brats, but they didn't really change that much through the movie. I know they kind of did, but I don't know. It didn't really work for me. And I know, you know, the secret garden, a big part of it is that the dad's supposed to be away and kind of not there. And Colin Firth is very much here for the movie. And I thought that kind of just didn't work as the story as much. The idea of Colin, the boy who is, you know, supposed to be taking after his dad with a hunchback and stuff. The relationship between him and Mary didn't work at all for me. It just really jarred and grated with me. I didn't think they were particularly likable characters in any way. You know, even when they got to the garden and it was this, you know, magical, lovely place, it just, that whole aspect of it, the actual characters just took it all away from me, and I didn't really have a particularly good time with it.
Oh dear.
I don't know.
Did you like the dog? That's a nice character.
I like the dog. I don't, you know what? I didn't mind the Robin. I didn't even really think about the CGI of the Robin. It was actually very well done.
So that's another poster quote from Jack there. I liked the dog and I didn't mind the Robin.
I know. I've seen, you know, a lot of people really enjoyed this movie and kind of found it seems like, you know, light escapism. I think that's fair. But it's just, it wasn't a movie for me. I found it quite...
Well, it's a real sort of Sunday tea time kind of film, right? It's a classic British story, you know, well acted, well shot, has this air of pathos and tragedy to it, but it's not going to blow your mind or anything. It's something that you watch that you can have gently sort of wash over you. I don't think it's anything more than that. So I enjoyed it on that level.
Yeah. And, you know, let's face it, if you have children that you need to occupy over half term, you know, this is something lovely that they can enjoy, but you can also enjoy without feeling like you're going to have a migraine. I'm thinking of you, Trolls World Tour. This is very sort of soothing and lovely and beautiful to look at.
Yes, it's a real shame that we're only getting it on. Well, it is coming out in cinemas as well, but
yes,
I imagine because of the current situation, most people are going to be watching this on Sky or Now TV in their own homes, which is a bit of a shame because it is a real visual feast. Like, I feel like it's the kind of film that actually really would have benefited from sitting in the cinema and watching it there. So it's a shame that most people are going to be exposed to it in their own homes, but, you know, it's what we got to live with right now.
So Jordan and I are recommending this for people who want to get a bit of the outside indoors. But, you know, Jack's only recommending this for Robin lovers. So if you are interested in seeing The Secret Garden, it is out in cinemas this Friday and it's also available on Sky Cinema. Right, shall we go from English gardens to the French coast?
Ça va, mon chéri?
Ouais.
Mon Dieu, mais qu'est-ce que tu viens faire?
Maman, ça chavire ici, tout ça, rien.
Un bon bain chaud, c'est tout ce qu'il te faut. Allez!
Avec ta mère, vous faites ça à tous les mecs qui chavirent.
C'est que c'est ma première fois.
Tu te détends, tu résistes jamais au mouvement. Tu te laisses aller.
Fait plaisir à voir tous les deux.
This is the summer of 85. Jack, what's happening in the summer of 85?
This is the story of a French boy called Alex who decides one day to take his boat out for a lovely time on the ocean. And then a storm comes very quickly and out of nowhere and his boat capsizes and another lad named David comes to rescue him. David takes Alex to his home and the two quickly form a strong relationship and quickly kind of, you know, fall romantically engaged. And then Alex actually goes and works for David as well. But this whole story is kind of tinged with a dark underbelly because we know it's all told in flashbacks and Alex is saying that David is actually a corpse. So he's dead. And so we kind of are waiting to find out how David died and Alex survived. And Alex is also being interrogated by the police for some reason. We don't quite know why. So it's an interesting kind of mystery at the center of this film as well that kind of keeps you going. So it's not just a, you know, a call me by your name repeat.
But it does really feel like they're reaching for that, doesn't it?
There are moments when they are, you know, there's like a disco and that feels very much kind of almost copy paste since, you know, the colors and the whole vibe of it. But I really enjoyed this film. Both the central performances were pretty great. The person who played Alex really carried it. And it was different enough from Call Me By Your Name to be interesting. You know, you did have this murder mystery kind of playing out. So I thought that was really well done. And, you know, there's a lot of links between Alex who's writing down what happened and kind of using words and writing to kind of expel demons from him and stuff. I really enjoyed that. Were you not the biggest fan, Jane?
I think it's probably because, you know, I love Call Me By Your Name. I felt like it was just trying so hard to capture some of that magic in this bottle, you know, sort of riding bikes around the 80s era, the music, the disco, like you say. It sort of felt very much like it was trying to copy that. That I didn't love. But because it was sort of like that, I sort of did love it. I loved the fact that, you know, Rod Stewart got an extended play of I Am Sailing in two very different scenes. That's got to be on our review of the year of song choice, I think. And the fact that, you know, it's this Normandy coast, I really enjoyed the travel porn of it. They filmed in La Tripot with this little lighthouse and these big white cliffs and this sea. And it made me want to go and have a croissant and look at that ocean. In terms of a sort of escapist film from the era and from the country, I kind of enjoyed it.
I would say that there's an English girl abroad in this who every time she spoke French, I was cringing so much because it was very much like, je m'appelle.
But that's how we all speak French.
I know. It's just so embarrassing, isn't it? It's like, as a Brit, I was like, oh no. She adds another twist in the tale of this, you know, relationship between these two boys. And I liked their relationship a lot. I mean, 2 weeks ago when we spoke about like unnecessary sex scenes and movies and stuff, they don't have to go to do anything graphic with this. It's very much kind of like a soft, nice, romantic relationship.
Yeah, the door is literally closed on any shenanigans in the bedroom, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, this is very much a romantic film, isn't it? And it's about teen romance and teen obsession and that idea of I want you forever and I cannot see any point where we wouldn't be together. And if anything happens to stop that sort of fantasy, the absolute devastation that causes. So it's very much a film that I think we can all relate to. We've all been there and felt that at some point in our lives, or might be going through it if we're teenagers right now. And it's only 90 minutes.
That surprises me a little bit because I haven't seen this film yet, but I know the films of Francois Ozon, you know, Swimming Pool, Jeanne Jolie and La Monte Double, if you saw any of those films. And he's not one to shy away from a bit of nudity, a bit of explicit on-screen sex when he wants to. So the fact that this is a bit more restrained actually appeals to me.
It does link to his other films in as much as it's about the sort of the twisted nature of romance and obsession. And those films sort of do explore that. And this certainly does to that degree. And also I really enjoyed Valeria Brunei-Tedeschi as David's mother, who's a little bit weird. She likes to bathe her teenage boys. And there's a very awkward scene where she tries to bathe Alex. It's actually surprisingly funny. So it's funny, quirky, romantic and travel porn. Not bad for a 90-minute French film.
I mean, I found this more escapism than The Secret Garden.
But it doesn't have a Robin in it, though, does it? So, you know,
it doesn't marks. Have a CGI Robin.
Yeah, lose marks for that.
Star off.
Yeah. Okay, so that is Summer of 85, which is out in cinemas this Friday. And finally, it's nearly Halloween, so it's time to get spooked with this.
I saw something in the dark. You have felt it too.
You're having problems with the puppy?
This is what they want. They like to see us crazy. Let them send us back.
How quickly you forget everything we went through to get here. We are not going back.
So this is his house. Jack, Tell us what this one's about.
His House tells the story of a refugee couple who managed to escape war-torn Saddam with their daughter. But unfortunately, on the way to the UK, they lose their daughter. So when they get here, they are rehoused by Doctor Who.
Matt Smith.
Matt Smith. Yeah, just to clarify which doctor. But their house is seemingly haunted by a creepy presence. They also, they have to adjust to UK living. So the man played by Sopé Dorussu, he kind of adjusts better to UK life. He goes to the pub and he sings about Peter Crouch. And then the woman played by Wunmi Mosaku kind of struggles more with the world around her and is kind of more kept into the house, which obviously has its own haunted problems. So Jane, what did you think of this one?
I love this. This is by director Remy Weeks. And I think this is very much sort of like one of those things that it's horror that actually shines a spotlight on a social issue via those tropes. And so as much as it is about the horror, which is really brilliantly done and malevolent and really unsettling, it is about refugees and how they settle in a new country and the sort of the haunted lives they lead because of the journey that they've made to get here, but also the sort of culture shock of having to try to adapt to an entirely new life. And I think it's really cleverly interwoven between those two things. And also the fact that it's this guy's house, but it obviously isn't. It's a council house that he's been given, and he's told as a refugee he cannot move house, he cannot leave that address, he has to show, you know, willing to stay there. So they are trapped with this malevolent spirit. And that is everyone's worst kind of horror, isn't it? Being trapped somewhere with something horrific and having no way out. So it just works really, really well.
Yeah, it feels kind of in a similar vein to those A24 elevated horror movies, you know, with some of the spooky aspects of it. There are jump scares in there, but the real world horrors kind of around them, the fact that they, you know, this woman feels trapped in her house, not by, you know, physical means, but by the external stuff that's going on around her, the world around her. And that was also terrifying in itself. And it kind of leaves you unnerved throughout the entire film. I thought the two central performances were both great as well. You know, their reactions to the horrors around them and the spirit in the house, you know, the mystery of that and why it's there and stuff plays out really well. You know, it all kind of ties in very much. It elevates it as well to make it even scarier.
And also, by the end, extremely sad. And, you know, there's a gut punch of a twist, which is brilliant. And it reminded me of things like Waves, also the sort of idea of A Quiet Place, in as much as it's just this central idea that is just taken and built out to 90 minutes of just beautifully crafted horror.
Yeah, and it's a different kind of haunted house to what we've seen before. There are kind of creepy things in the walls and scattering around and
scuttling.
You know, yeah, all these faces that kind of like poke out these holes and things. It's really interesting. And there are some scenes that are kind of more dreamlike as well that take us away from the house. It's not just a, you know, it's not a single location movie. It takes us, you know, far and away. And those are really affecting as well. You know, some of the cinematography in this is really, really fun. And there's kind of an ethereal feeling to some of these moments as well. Yeah, I thought it was really, really well done.
Will you be watching it, Jordan?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to save this one for Halloween. Sounds like a perfect spooky night watch.
Okay, so if you fancy His House, it's on Netflix from this Friday. Okay, so that is it. That's been a busy week. But before we go, shall we answer a reader's question? What's a movie, character or scene that's haunted you? Jordan?
Well, the one that stands out to me is both a character and a scene.
Yeah.
Which is when you finally see Nina in Wreck, the Spanish fan footage horror film. I really don't get scared at films most of the time, but I thought that entire film was just unbelievably intense and absolutely terrifying. And that final sequence where Angela, the reporter, is creeping around in the attic and, you know, whispering under her breath, like trying not to alert Nina, this like blind monstrosity to her presence, was like just too much. Like, I couldn't handle it. The way she sort of appears in and out of the shadows based on the night vision of the camera is just ingenious. And the makeup on Javier Botet, the actor, is just phenomenal. He's this actor with something called Marfan syndrome, which means he has these incredibly long incredibly slim limbs, arms and legs, which are just perfect for playing these seemingly inhuman characters. That scene really messed me up for a long time. I didn't want to go into my attic ever again.
Jack.
I think that did haunt me was the trailer for The Ring, but I've never actually watched the entire film because I was so scared when I was a youngster. But I think like one scene that sticks out to me, this Mulholland Drive, when they're in the diner and then there's kind of the build up and this dreamlike sequence and they go outside and there's the kind of homeless man out the back. That has always stuck with me. I don't know why. It just is. It's so well done. And I think because it's in broad daylight, you know, and it's not necessarily in a horror movie. I mean, you know, it's a Lynch film, so it's kind of what you expect. But I mean, you can watch that one scene on its own without the rest of the movie and still get a fright. But within the entire thing, I think it almost adds something more to it because it lulls you into a full sense of not security because the whole movie's strange itself, but you don't expect it to be quite like that. So that would probably be my take. Well, how about you, Jane?
Well, mine are both childhood things. One is obviously the child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Just the way he skips down the street with his wagon of sweeties. It makes me feel very funny now when I think about it. And his long nose and his beady eyes and the fact that he can smell children in the woodwork. And his lank hair, ugh, disgusting lank hair. Everything about him is just horrible. And then the other thing that I watched far too young and still creeps me out is obviously The Thing. John Carpenter's version. And the scene that used to absolutely terrify me is when they're testing the blood in the Petri dishes and there's the hot soldering iron and it's squeaking on the bottom of the glass and it's, are you the thing? Nope. Are you the thing? And you're just waiting to see who's going to just transmogrify into this disgusting thing. And when it happens, it's truly terrifying. It's this disgusting molten, oh, no, I can't. So that's mine. It still haunts me. And obviously, I love the spider head in that, but that's more of a like that tickles you rather than horrifies you, doesn't it? But yeah, that particular scene where they're testing blood is so tense and so horrific. So that's it then. Please do buy the magazine. It is out now with James Bond on the cover, even though he isn't coming to cinemas for some months. But you can read all about it in Jordan's amazing cover story. What's the best thing in that cover story, Jordan?
I love the fact that the stunt coordinator, Lee Morrison, told me that they sprayed 60,000 euros worth of Coca-Cola over Matera in Italy for one of the film's major action set pieces because it provides more traction for the tires of cars and motorbikes. So it's for safety.
Probably attracts a lot of wasps as well.
Yeah. And then it washes off and leaves the stonework incredibly clean, apparently. So
there you go. There's your Bond fact for today. Okay, so join us next week. We will be returning. But for now, let's say goodbye, chaps.
Bye.
Goodbye.
That was creepy. Goodbye.
Great success.